Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, former JEA executives lose their bid to get federal criminal charges against them dropped. Columnist Nate Monroe breaks down the judge's decision. Plus, a $10 million commitment to keep Jacksonville residents from losing their homes when new development moves in. And the community steps up to house international refugees. Then, a warm tribute to beloved PBS television icon Mr. Rogers. But first, joining me in studio, Nate Monroe, Metro columnist at the Florida Times Union. Nate is perhaps second only to federal prosecutors when it comes to knowing the backstory of the JEA debacle. For those of you tuning in, have you been following the federal criminal case against the former JEA executives? What questions do you have about what's happening in the case? Give us a call, 549-2937, tag us on X at FCC on Air, or send us an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also message us on Facebook and Instagram. So good morning, Nate. Thanks for being here.
It is a pleasure.
It is a pleasure to have you. So there were some major developments in the case this week. I'm going to ask you to tell us about that in just a minute. But first, give us a reset on the case. Remind us what this criminal case is about and how it started.
Yeah, sure. As a lot of listeners will probably recall, there was a little bit of a controversial effort several years ago to privatize JEA, to sell it to a private operator. JEA is a city-owned electric, water, and sewer utility, one of the largest in the United States. And the two of the individuals who led that privatization campaign, JEA's former CEO, Aaron Zahn, and CFO, Ryan Wanamaker, were indicted in March of last year on allegations that they essentially tried to skim profits off the top of that sale. Of course, the sale never did happen, and they never did actually get any sort of payouts. But you know, federal prosecutors think that that plan went far enough to justify conspiracy and fraud charges.
And their charges are tied to the sale attempt because they would have essentially benefited had the utility been sold.
Yeah, I mean, that's the rough way to think about this, and I may be stripping away a little bit of nuance, is to say that they were going to skim profits off the top of a sale. So a sale would have been in the billions of dollars range, and federal prosecutors believe that the profits they were going to extract out of it could have been in the hundreds of millions of dollars range.
And so these two gentlemen are charged with conspiracy and wire fraud. They've both pleaded not guilty. So the criminal investigation began under the auspices of the sale, or because of this plan that they were going to skim, allegedly profit from?
So we know now that federal prosecutors and FBI agents actually started looking at JEA in late 2019 and did not specifically start looking at it because of this, kind of bonus plan that sort of ended up forming kind of the heart of the indictment. That was, I don't think, initially why they started looking. I think they started looking because there was just a lot of acrimony and outcry in the community about how the sale was being done. It was very secretive. It was all moving very fast. There were, the stakes were really high. Again, there were billions of dollars at stake here. And so I think just the kind of controversial nature of it is what put it on their radar. And it was not until early 2020, March, April, that I think they started developing a theory about this profit skimming bonus plan.
And the way that whole issue rolled out, it was the controversy of the sale. Even at the meeting where they, voted the JEA board to pursue the idea of privatization, this bonus plan was sort of buried in that meeting, almost like a footnote. And it seems like the investigation also followed a similar pattern.
Yes. I mean, the entire case revolves around the July 23rd, 2019 board of directors meeting where privatization was authorized. And at the very, very end of the meeting, the board did greenlight this kind of opaque, what looked like an employee incentive plan. Prosecutors have since said, and I think there was a lot of coverage and a lot of other non-criminal investigations of this meeting that preceded the federal case. A lot of people came to believe that Zahn and Wanamaker essentially disguised a very lucrative bonus plan as an otherwise pretty harmless technical sort of employee incentive program.
Mm-hmm. So that brings us up to the current issue, the case. So there was a decision this week. In May, you and I spent, it seemed like an eternity in hearings.
It was 8 days.
Eight days. 8 days in federal court is, I think, in like human years, probably like at least 6 weeks, right?
At least, yeah.
But those hearings, the defendants in the case hoped that they would scuttle the case. Essentially, they were asking the judge to say that this indictment was illegitimate. So tell us what's going on with that now.
Yeah, I mean, this was, I think, the hearing was the culmination of like the primary pretrial strategy that the former CEO and CFO were sort of making to head off this indictment, or at the least to get the current prosecutor kicked off the case. I mean, they were looking for any sort of, you know, way to tie prosecutors' hands or weaken the case. So just to say up front, the issues at the core of this recent decision are a bit complicated. There's not a really super easy way to explain this, but there is anyone who's watched a police procedural or a courtroom drama knows what it means to plead the fifth. You know, you have a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. There is a legal concept called Garrity rights. Garrity rights essentially extend that Fifth Amendment protection to government employees. Just listeners, take my word for it that there are times when government employees do not really enjoy Fifth Amendment protections the way that everyone else does. There are times when they can be compelled to sit and comply with like administrative or internal investigations and answer questions that are asked of them and answer them fully and truthfully, whether they incriminate them or not. Courts have said that those kinds of statements and those kinds of contexts cannot be used to prosecute them in the future. Zahn and Wanamaker sat for Garrity interviews near the end of their tenures at JEA. The board had asked city attorneys to conduct a workplace investigation. And both of them spoke with city attorneys for hours and hours. Zahn actually sat for 2 days. And so what they were essentially arguing was that federal prosecutors had likely used material from these protected statements that they provided to build their criminal case, or that knowledge about what was said in their interviews somehow like tainted the entire case, because and you'll remember this, the transcripts of their interviews became public records. And so, you know, ordinarily Garrity protected statements don't get like really reported on and they don't get publicly disseminated. And so that was the big dispute at the core of this like 8 day hearing that you and I sat through.
And so they were saying because the prosecutors were aware of this, you know, privileged or otherwise not admissible, you know, testimony that they'd given, that their entire investigation was tainted and not legitimate.
That's right.
And so the judge says what?
The judge issued, a magistrate judge issued a 103-page decision.
This week
on Monday, that essentially said, you know, the prosecution in that 8 day hearing successfully demonstrated that it marshaled evidence totally independent of those Garrity statements, and that to the extent there, even if you assume there was some tainted evidence, there is enough independent evidence of wrongdoing to justify this indictment. You know, he made lots of credibility findings about the government's witnesses. And he really, and there are portions of this ruling that are redacted, but I think pretty thoroughly picked apart a lot of the defense's arguments and, you know, essentially said, look, making theoretical connections between Garrity protected statement and what the evidence in the indictment is just not enough.
So case is still on for trial as it currently stands. When is that?
February.
And you'll be there?
Of course.
How long is it going to last?
I think the trial could very well last about a month.
All right. Merit badges for Nate Monroe, Metro columnist at the Florida Times Union. Thank you so much for being here and updating us on the case.
Of course. Anytime.
All right. We're going to be right back with a plan to protect longtime homeowners from displacement when their community is redeveloped. See you in a minute. Welcome back. I'm joined by Melanie Patz, president and CEO of United Way of Northeast Florida, and our own Will Brown, reporter for Jacksonville Today, who focuses on issues of race, inequality, and poverty. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Melanie, let's start with you. The United Way announced a big deal this week. Let's talk about it.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, we announced $10 million toward affordable housing. We have experienced, as all of us have, an increase in housing costs, and we're really concerned, particularly about people who are at the lower end of the income level and their ability to find homes and stay in their homes.
And so you're focusing on some neighborhoods that are being affected by redevelopment, in some cases being possibly influenced by gentrification. So talk about the areas of funding that you're going to assign this $10 million to.
Thank you. The $10 million is broken down into $4 million for preservation, and that is specific to communities along the Emerald Trail, and starting with East Jacksonville and Historic Riverside.
And remind us what the Emerald Trail is and why that is a focus point.
Yeah, thank you. The Emerald Trail is an effort to connect parks in our community and development of those parks. And what we know from talking with Clyde Evans, who's the executive director of the Atlanta Beltline, is that when development like that occurs in a community, it increases the cost of housing in those communities. So there's a lot of economic activity that happens, which is a good thing. We want to make sure that the families who are living in those communities, who've been there in many cases for generations, have the ability to stay.
So that's $4 million. You're going to be trying to help 12,000 local residents in that area retain their homes. Where's the rest of the money going to be going?
$5 million to infill development, and that could be multifamily housing or single family homes. And it's to help developers build out the capital stack that they need to make a project work financially. And then $1 million to increase the capacity of our nonprofit developers in our community.
So I want to talk in a minute about the issue of heirs property and explain what that is. But Will, you've been covering issues, including the pressures of gentrification on established communities in Jacksonville. What are you hearing from those communities in your reporting?
People who live in neighborhoods like North Riverside, out east, even, you know, La Villa, they want to stay in their homes. They want to find ways to stay in their homes. But one of the issues is sometimes their homes are so old that the upkeep is expensive. And that upkeep is a little bit more than what their finances are able to cover, especially with inflation the way it is. And so, you know, it's, do I want to improve my roof or do I want to make sure that my JEA bill is paid? And so people prioritize, obviously, their JEA bill. So that is one of the pressures that people see is they want to be able to live in their homes and maintain their homes. But because those homes are considerably older than newer construction, there are some costs to maintain those homes that they may or may not have the liquid ability to finance.
And so I know there's a really good object example of that kind of pressure happening in St. Augustine, where you have a historic Black community of Lincolnville, which is just south of the downtown area, which was fairly impoverished in the 90s, you know, blighted in a lot of ways, but now is just a thriving sort of bed and breakfast community. It's forced out a lot of the people that called it home for generations.
Yes, and I worked in St. Augustine for years and would run into people who lamented that the community that they grew up in is not the community that they grew up in now. And so, you know, one of the things that I've noticed when speaking with people from North Riverside, the North Riverside CDC over the months or just listening to their perspective, is they really want to stay in their homes and they want to be able to maintain that feel that they had. They're not saying we don't want any new people to come in. They're not saying that at all. They're saying we just want the folks who are coming into our neighborhoods to understand the culture and the history of this neighborhood and come to be a part of it instead of coming to change it.
So, Melanie, we're hearing a lot more these days about something called heirs property. That's H-E-I-R-S. Explain to us what heirs property is.
It's very simply, someone owns a home, they die, they bequeath it to a relative, but they don't have a will or some other legal document doing that. And as a result, the family member or friend or whomever who receives the home thinks that they own it legally, only to find out that they don't. And typically when they find out, it's under unusual and unhappy circumstances, like they've had some sort of tragedy, natural disaster, and they're trying to get FEMA support, but they cannot prove legal ownership of the home and therefore don't qualify for FEMA support. Or they're trying to do something really good, either for the home or for themselves, and get a mortgage on the home, but they don't qualify because they don't have legal ownership.
And how big of a problem is that here in Jacksonville?
Huge. 12,000 homes.
What does that mean for people in terms of generational wealth or the accrual of such?
So first, let me say our partner in this work is LISC Jacksonville, and they partner with Three Rivers Legal Services, which is a nonprofit legal organization. So you mentioned generational wealth in the United States for many years. We have typically grown wealth for most families through homeownership. And when you don't have legal ownership of the home, then that thwarts that process. And it's so widespread. Some families are able to address it quickly when they identify it. For other families, there are so many potential heirs that it's very difficult for them to address. So we really encourage people to get a will.
And the money that you're going to be able to offer, is that for legal services?
For both. Mm-hmm. For legal services, we're also trying to spread the word and make prevention more accessible for folks so that they can affordably get a will, so that when they do die, there's no question about the legal ownership of their home.
So, Will, you said that, you know, there's enthusiasm for neighborhood revitalization. The Emerald Trail, in many ways, is a promise of the city's effort to become a more livable community, a more resilient community, but it impacts marginalized communities. I know you've been speaking to people in the community. Let's start here with a little sound from someone you talked to. Set it up for me. Was this
This was earlier this spring. This was after a North Riverside CDC meeting where Melanie spoke for a good while to people to assuage their fears that they might have, that that they might lose their homes or this is some kind of trick. And she was really able to break it down and explain, no, we are here to help. And so the woman I spoke with, her name is Phyllis Brown. I joked that if I can't spell her last name properly, I should get out this business. And she has lived in North Riverside for 60 years.
All right, let's hear what she had to say.
Why would I sell my house? It's like, this is where I grew up. This is where I live. I don't want to move. I have no intentions of moving. And the way housing prices are now, I'm not going to be able to afford anything else. I got it good considering. So needs a little repairs, I'll do those. And I like the people, because most people in my neighborhood have been there since they were kids. We grew up together.
So, Melanie, some of the targeted neighborhoods are communities.
They are
intact and, you know, longstanding communities.
In fact, I met Tony yesterday, who, very much like Phyllis, said, thank you for the resources to repair my home. Not only did you help me stay in my home, but you're helping all of my neighbors stay in their homes and you're stabilizing our neighborhood.
And so, Will, in your reporting, are people finding a way to put this money to use? Are they able to connect to the resources in a way that is efficient and you know, really useful to them?
Yes. And one of the ways that they're able to do that is by going through their local community development corporation, because the folks who are leaders of these community development corporations, like out on the east side, it's Suzanne Pickett. She's from out east. I think she lives nearby out east. I can't remember specifically where she lives, but she's very much involved in the community. So when she says, hey, this is something that is beneficial, people will listen to her probably more than they'll listen to a lot of other different people. And so by going through the CDCs, that information is flowing from the CDCs to residents, and residents know, can get information on how to improve their homes through community development corporations. Same thing with North Riverside. Their president, Miss Shirley Thomas, I think is the last name. She's lived in North Riverside for a few decades. I promised her I'd never say how many.
but good man.
I'm from the South. So she's lived in North Riverside for a few decades. So she has that ability to she has that trust in the community that when she says this is good for the community, people believe her.
And so, Melanie, where is this pile of cash coming from?
Great question. We were very fortunate to receive $20 million from Mackenzie Scott back in December of 2020. And since then, we have been funding programs that are helping us achieve our vision of a community of opportunity where everyone has hope and can achieve their full potential. Our board last October indicated that they wanted to take some of the funds and make sure that we had more affordable housing available for our community. So we initiated a task force that was co-chaired by Mari Qureshi with the Jesse Paul DuPont Fund and Andre Wallace of JAX USA. And they met January through June and came up with the recommendations that our board approved a couple of months ago.
We've got a caller, Charlay from Jacksonville, has a comment on affordable housing. Good morning, Charlay. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hi, good morning. I love First Coast Connect. I've been in Jacksonville for almost 20-some years, and this program is just amazing, and I love that it gives an opportunity for residents to be able to call in and participate.
Well, thank you for doing that.
Yes. Well, first of all, I love the fact that there are resources to help stabilize neighborhoods, especially in the Riverside area, even in, you know, other surrounding areas as well. That's, you know, that's wonderful. But I feel like whenever I hear plans about affordable housing, it's, you know, it talks about development or includes development to create housing to house people. I don't ever hear any plans about providing, you know, opportunities for funding for ownership. And even in the times that we're in now, especially in this area and, you know, and across Florida, there should be, you know, monies and programs set aside to lead into home ownership. Because when we're talking about economic development, you know, that's a start. If you're in a development that is just kind of, you know, people don't have a stake in the community, they're just renting in these high rises that are highly populated, you know, it may be a boost in the economy as far as, you know.
Thanks, Charlay. I'm going to just let Melanie respond a little bit, but thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. Melanie, what do you say to that?
Charlay, that's a great point. And I will say that the city of Jacksonville does have a down payment assistance program. So I encourage you to go to the website and see what the criteria are for qualifying. Those are some of the things that our task force looked at. Where are the needs? Where are the gaps? And by the way, $10 million is not going to solve our affordable housing challenges. So it's going to take a lot of support from a lot of other organizations. Anyone who's interested in joining us, we encourage you to get in touch. Our phone number is 390-3200.
And that's seed money, essentially. You're saying that this $10 million is a start. But what do you think is there a number that you could put that maybe would help really move the needle?
Yeah, so it's a big number. And we just did a back of the envelope calculation in the zip codes that we're concerned about in Jacksonville and came up with $350 million.
And, you know, to your point about the down payment assistance program, it is November, so it is early in the fiscal year. And usually those down payment assistance programs have more money at the beginning of the city's fiscal year. The city's fiscal year begins October 1st. You know, this might be the time to really look into those programs because it's earlier in the fiscal year when the city, because my understanding is it's first come, first serve with some of the down payment assistance. And to the caller's point, there's an initiative, LISC Jacksonville led it, Project Boots, that is getting people, you know, home ownership training, and they provide them some training. I want to say I don't know if they provide funding, but they do. For people to live on the east side. They're starting on the east side, and if it's successful, I think they have aspirations of expanding to other areas, but it's a way to get mixed income housing in predominantly Black neighborhoods that have surrounded downtown, so places like the east side and North Riverside can kind of resist some of the gentrification that took place in Brooklyn.
And the Emerald Trail ties into this. How are these are all neighborhoods that are kind of adjacent to, or
the Emerald Trail is connected through these neighborhoods. So I can't remember every specific neighborhood, but the neighborhoods of North Riverside, like Lackawanna and Mixontown, the Emerald Trail goes through there. The Emerald Trail touches the east side. It touches the Phoenix neighborhood, which is a little bit north of the east side. there are other neighborhoods that it touches, La Villa as well. Mm-hmm. Want to say, yes, it definitely touches Durkeyville. I drive by that part every single day.
I think even in that Phoenix Arts District, they're kind of going to find a way to connect themselves to the trail, you know, to take advantage of that, you know, that environment and that mobility that people are going to have for walking and biking and such.
Right.
But there are a lot of neighborhoods that are really starting to experience a lot of change. And Phoenix is one of them. But, you know, I think sometimes called the Rail Yard District, but kind of in that Mixon Town area, there's, you know, all these new breweries and kind mm-hmm. of like hip places. And
it's interesting, like the whole idea of the Rail Yard District is kind of an example of gentrification in a way, because, you know, neighborhood resident, longtime North Riverside residents are just like, wait a minute now, this is not what we call this place. The Rail Yard District was created by businesses, but it was created by businesses without the consult of the community. And community leaders they scoff at the idea of it being called the Rail Yard District when for years and years it was either Mixon Town or Lackawanna or I think Hollybrook, not the Rail Yard District. So that's a little bit of a point of contention.
Yeah, I would think it would be disorienting if people just kind of rename your neighborhood. How does that happen, Melanie?
Well, I think it certainly wasn't ill-intended. And so it was businesses coming together to see how they could spur some economic development in their community. And, you know, just saw the Rail Yard as an opportunity for them to create an identity.
We've got a call, Daryl from St. Augustine. Good morning, Daryl. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. I'm trying to figure out, and maybe you journalists can do an investigation and figure out what happened, what changed. I ran all over Northeast Florida by foot, by bicycle, by motorcycle, the same in the Northwestern United States. I never once, as a child in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, saw a homeless person. We rumored they were living under the bridge, but I never found one. I never saw one. Something has changed in the way we finance it, the way we build it, greed. I don't know what it is, but something's changed. Just do whatever we did in 1970, and you'll fix the homeless problem.
All right, Daryl, thanks for the call. Melanie, what do you say to that?
So there's a couple of factors that have happened. One of them is how we fund mental health services in our country. So that was a huge impact back in the 60s and the 70s that resulted in a lot of people losing their homes as well as their treatment. And then, of course, increasing unaffordability. So housing prices go up and that makes it unaffordable for people.
We're actually going to be talking about, you know, the impacts of those mental health changes in that era in a discussion Monday with your buddy, Sam Garrison. So that'll be an interesting conversation, but obviously that is part of a very complicated set of circumstances, Will.
And I remember back in January when the United Way announced this initiative to the Affordable Housing Task Force, I think it was Andre Wallace who mentioned how much housing prices have skyrocketed just since the onset of the pandemic right here in Northeast Florida. And that was one of the reasons why the task force was created in the first place, because I don't want to say the wrong date number on air, but housing prices increased substantially, I think at least 25% between, you know, the onset of the pandemic in March 2020 and when Andre Wallace was speaking in January of 2023. And that makes a big impact on people who are living check to check trying to afford a home.
Yeah, so Will, it's more than that, actually. What we've got, the Alice report that is produced every year, 40% of Northeast Floridians are either living as Alice or in poverty, which means they just can't afford to live. And
40%.
So in 2021, when the data was gathered, housing prices at that time were approximately half of what they are today.
Lots to continue to dig into here. Will Brown, reporter for Jacksonville Today, thank you for your great reporting on this topic. And Melanie Patz, president and CEO of United Way of Northeast Florida, thank you so much for being here and talking about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back to discuss refugee resettlement and how you can help. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm joined by Laura Cook, Refugee Resettlement Director and Consolidated Refugee Services Contract Manager at Lutheran Social Services. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. So Jacksonville has traditionally been a welcoming city for refugees, has had a lot of successful programs in the past to integrate newcomers. What interactions have you had with the organization, with recent immigrants in the area? What is the situation currently that LSS is managing?
Yeah, so we are serving a lot of people, way more than we have the past few years. This year, we're projected to have over 500 arrivals in our resettlement program that we receive refugees from the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program from. Last year, we served over 2,500 refugees, asylees, Cuban and Haitian entrants. And so we are going to serve that much this year and even more. So we're really excited. But that does require more assistance from our community. And we've been really fortunate to see our community just be very welcoming to the people who are settling, very generous in donating in-kind items or money, spending their time with our programs and with our clients. So we're really thankful to be in a city like that because it's not like that everywhere.
So what are the core services that LSS provides to newcomers?
Yeah, so those traveling through the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program have an intensive 90-day program that they're in, where we basically give them a tutorial of how to live in the United States and we how to be self-sufficient. So we put them in housing, we get them employed, we enroll their children in school, set them up with benefits, help them navigate the healthcare system. We do cultural orientation, which is like a crash course to living in the United States. And then we just help them navigate the community and know the different resources available to them. And then after 90 days, they have up to 5 years to come back for other services like youth and mentoring. We have career laddering where they can go to certificate programs. They can try to ladder up in their job that they have or get a new job. We help them get their green card or even citizenship at 5 years. And so there's a lot. And we also have English that they can attend for free up to 5 years. And even if they test higher than our classes, they can go to FSCJ.
And it's a tough transition a lot of times. People sometimes leaving their countries, working as professional people in their countries, you know, doctors in other capacities, and then coming to an environment where they don't speak the language and they are not certified in that same field. How do you help people adjust to maybe not being able to work in the field that they have trained in?
Yeah, it's really humbling when people have spent many years in training and in high positions in their home country, and they come here and they have to start at the bottom. And so they usually enter into like tech jobs if they have enough English in the field that they were in, and then try to study for national boards or go back for whatever training is required for them to do their profession here in the United States.
So I know one thing that you're looking for is people to get involved. If you have questions about the Lutheran Social Services Refugee Resettlement Program, give us a call at 549-2937 or email us at WJCT at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out to us on social media. So Laura Cook, what are the main challenges that refugees face when they come to Jacksonville, and how does providing like a host family environment mitigate some of those challenges?
Yeah, so they, the individuals that come are very hardworking, but they've never been here before. They don't know the culture. They don't know the language, some of them, and they don't know our healthcare system and everything that, you know, entails being successful here in the United States. So having somebody in the community that walks alongside them, linking them to those resources, showing them how to navigate the different aspects of life, they are able to take that and run with that and be extremely successful and self-sufficient and become contributing members of our community. So that's what we're looking to do. As we start our new program, the Circle of Welcome, we are looking for small groups of people, 6 to 10 individuals coming together, being trained on how to mentor a family and walk alongside a newly arrived family for 6 months.
And so you're asking people to come and sort of audition for the Circle of Welcome. How do you screen people?
Yeah, so it's going to be a vetting process. They'll be level 2 background screened, and they'll be able to go to informational session to kind of see what does this entail? Do I want to commit to this? Because it's a time commitment. And these families are, you know, you're building these relationships and it's really important for them to have a relationship that's going to last. So we'll be doing vetting or the information sessions, and then there'll be training on cultural competency and then the things that they need to know how to navigate and how they can help them succeed.
Do you think that there's people out there who maybe don't think they would be qualified for this and maybe would be an appropriate host family?
Yeah, everybody has strengths that they contribute to these families. And that's why 6 to 10 people, they all have different strengths. And I think that would really play to help that family succeed in their first few years in the United States.
So to be clear, this is like a group that comes together and they share hosting responsibilities?
Right. So sort of. They, it could be like a small group, maybe coworkers, neighbors. It could be a small group from a church. And so they would sit down with us and they're going to say, and we'll say, okay, these are all the things that have to happen the first 90 days to 6 months. What are you able to do? So maybe they'll be like, oh, okay, I can help enroll them in school. I can help show them where to go to the grocery store or help set up their apartment. And we'll kind of be like a relationship with LSS and them and making sure that all the services are done that will help them be integrated as fast as possible.
But the host families, are they living with these hosts are the families, the refugee families, staying with them, or are they independently living? How does that work?
Yeah, so we find apartments for them prior to them arriving in the United States because we have a 1 to 5 week notice of them arriving. So that group will also help us set up that apartment for them and make it a homey environment, a welcoming environment. And they can even go to the airport with us when we pick up that family, and their services will start from there.
So Jacksonville has a really rich history of, you know, refugees, immigrants, generally speaking. There's a lot of Syrian people, mm-hmm. Lebanese people, Palestinian residents represented in our seats of power. We've had 2 mayors, former general counsels, a state attorney, all of whom came from, you know, a diaspora that came and settled in this region. And so how is the current profile of the refugees that you're seeing changing? Where are they predominantly originating from? And are they being driven out by conflict?
Yeah. So last year, 30% of people that we served were Cuban and Haitians. And then our biggest nationalities were Ukrainian, Afghan, Congolese, Syrian, and Burmese. And so they all are going through some kind of conflict abroad. A lot of them had been waiting for a while to travel to the United States because of COVID. And then we had the Afghan refugee crisis. So a lot of people's cases were put on standby while they waited until it was their turn to arrive.
And so how do you help them cope? Obviously, that's a very tumultuous process, can be very traumatic, I would imagine, the circumstances that they've been in. So what services are available for them on that front?
Yeah, a lot of services are available. They do have access to mental health counseling. They're screened at the Refugee Health Clinic downtown. And we have their medical profile before they come. So we're able to pre-book appointments for them or get them into specialists that they need to see to help them with any physical or mental issues that they may be experiencing.
And how do you mitigate pressures and you know, sometimes like a political environment that maybe is less welcoming to people who are immigrating to the United States?
Yeah, so in our circumstances, I think a lot has to do with education. The individuals that we come are heavily vetted. They're the most vetted people that come to the United States. They have gone through a number of screenings, biodata screens. And so I think that people don't understand that. And once they arrive, the United States is welcoming them here. And so once they arrive in the United States and they step off that airplane, they have an employment authorization. They're taxpaying community members. I think that a lot of that has to do just with education. And once people know why they're here, you know, they don't want to leave their home. They're persecuted or have a well-founded fear of persecution, and that's their only option is to leave. And their only option is to come to another country like this, not just to like try to survive life, but to thrive. And I think when the community members really understand that, they have a lot more compassion and more welcoming.
And these are people who really want to be here and succeed here.
Yes, they're very excited. They're anxious to get working. They're anxious to get their kids in school and just to get some like normalcy to their life.
So how can people get involved if they want to participate in this circle of welcome?
Yes, yeah, so you can go on to lssjax.org, or they can email volunteers@lssjax.org to become a part of our circle of welcome. We are now currently hiring for that position, and we're going to launch the program in January. And so we're really excited. And we think this is going to be a really great option, a really great add-on for our clients. And they think that they're going to become more integrated into community through this.
And how many people are you hoping to land in this drive?
Our first year, our target is 10 teams, 10 teams of 10 to 6 individuals. But I think we can do better than that.
Really?
Yeah. All right. I think Jacksonville is a very welcoming community. I think once the word's out there, a lot of people will be interested in playing this important part, having an impact in these community members' lives.
Well, Laura Cook, with Refugee Resettlement with Lutheran Social Services, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And stick with us. In just a minute, a childhood television icon continues to inspire. We'll be right back.
The indigenous history of Northeast Florida stretches back more than 12,000 years, but that story often gets oversimplified down to a few talking points that probably aren't even true.
To me, it's that fish story where it's told and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but the thing here is there was never fish to begin with.
In Bygone Jacks, Our Unsung History, a podcast from WJCT Public Media, we tackle three of the most common myths about Jacksonville's indigenous people and explore the far more fascinating true story, available wherever you get your podcasts.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
The 42nd Annual Gainesville Downtown Festival and Art Show is this weekend, featuring 200 artists, live music on 5 stages, kids' activities, and international cuisine. More at gainesvilledowntownartfest.net, supported by Visit Gainesville, Alachua County.
The indigenous history of Northeast Florida stretches back more than 12,000 years, but that story often gets oversimplified down to a few talking points that probably aren't even true.
To me, it's that fish story where it's told and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but the thing here is there was never fish to begin with.
In Bygone Jacks, Our Unsung History, a podcast from WJCT Public Media, we tackle three of the most common myths about Jacksonville's indigenous people and explore the far more fascinating true story, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm old enough to remember Kevin McCarthy reaching across the aisle to make a deal with Democrats to keep the government open and then swiftly losing his job for doing so. But this week, his successor, Mike Johnson, did the exact same thing, exact aisle, same Democrats, a deal he'd never support as a regular congressional Republican, and he's going to keep his job as Speaker. How that works, coming next time on Today Explained.
Tonight at 6:30, here on WJCT Money. News 89.9.
The debate over UFOs has changed.
You now see sort of serious people talking seriously about this subject.
Writer Garrett Graff has been tracking how far the discussion of the unknown has moved. Next time on 1A, he lays out why the topic has shifted beyond those in tinfoil hats and is now the subject of congressional hearings.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. Fred Rogers, who many of us nostalgically know as Mr. Rogers, once said there are three ways to ultimate success. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind. The third way is to be kind. As we make our way into the holiday season, there are abundant opportunities to practice kindness, beginning with the annual Mr. Rogers Neighborhood Sweater Drive, which is taking place now through the end of November. Here with more details are my big boss, David McGowan, president and CEO of WJCT, and Kamal Gasper, Vice President of Community Engagement at Vistar Credit Union. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Kamal, I'm thinking you are probably way too young to have grown up as I did watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but his legacy has really stood the test of time, whether it's the 2018 documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, or later a film starring Tom Hanks. What is the enduring appeal of Mr. Rogers?
So our purpose is to do good, and our core value is to lead by example. Ever since Vistar was founded in 1952 by 12 members on Naval Air Station Jacksonville. And this year, we are planning to give around roughly $6.3 million to the community through sponsorships and infrastructure investments. And our employees have volunteered 25,000 hours in the community to give back. And that is our purpose. And so we latch on to amazing ideas, amazing things in the community, like the Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. We've been a part of it since 2015 and helped last year to get 6,000 pounds of necessities for those that are most vulnerable.
That's terrific. David McGowan, what is the origin story of the annual Sweater Drive? How did it get going?
It got going some time ago, actually. It was something that takes place in many public media organizations across the country. And I think, you know, it's one of my favorite things that we do here because it illustrates so well, I think, what we can do when we work together with other partners to make something special happen. You know, Vistar is a great example. We have collection points throughout the city that Vistar helps provide and also Tom Bush dealerships provide. Sudduth is a partner in it, and they help us move all of this, these thousands of pounds of donations where they're needed. We, of course, provide not only collection points and organize the whole thing, but we also, of course, publicize this to our community. So everyone does what they do best, and it really creates something amazing and special, and it's really enduring, and that is a kind of a testament to its success.
And built around Mr. Rogers, who's this beloved PBS character.
Yeah, so iconic. I mean, we call it a sweater drive, by the way. I should point out that, and we call it a sweater drive, of course, because of the iconic sweater that Mr. Rogers wore every single day and changed into those. I am old enough, Anne, to remember growing up with Mr. Rogers.
Solidarity.
And that sweater. But we collect all kinds of things that are in need. And I should make two special points, I think, to our audience today. One is, and this is a shout out to the men out there, women are much better, and I can say this because this is true in my household, women are much better at cleaning out their closets and getting rid of the stuff that they don't wear anymore. Men, come on, it's not your time to do this, and because we end up with a lot more women's clothing than men's, and we really need men's. There's a lot of demand and need for that, and we see that when we're at the City Rescue Mission and at Clara White Mission. The other thing to say is that especially now, we're in need of new socks and underwear. So it's not only, you know, used things that we collect. If you feel so inclined and you're at Walmart or anywhere shopping and you kind of grab a six-pack of socks or whatever it may be to you know, drop off at one of the collection points, that would really, really be helpful.
And so that's he's calling out directly the men in the community.
Yes.
Get
we
in that closet.
We talked about it. Yeah.
That's right. And so Vistar is providing what is specifically locations? How do they? What's their involvement in the sweater drive?
Absolutely. So our members look forward to this every year. So we have collection points like David mentioned in Duval, St. John's, Nassau, Clay, Putnam, Bradford, and even Columbia County Vistar branches. So you come and visit. We have those three boxes located in the branch. stop in. Hopefully you're a member, can do a transaction, but if not, stop in, make a donation, and we're proud to support this amazing cause. I will mention that, you know, a lot of individuals think that maybe this event is for those that are homeless or unhoused, but you had Melanie Patz on the show earlier, and they talk about the ALICE study quite a bit, and that's individuals that are working but are one paycheck away from homelessness. And there's a lot of need out there in the community for those that may be working but may be struggling to meet their needs. And so this is a great opportunity for everybody that needs, that's most vulnerable.
And that's right. There really is this community of people who are right on the edge. That ALICE study, there's 40% of the population that is not economically stable. That means if they need to go to the doctor, if they need to get their car repaired, they're not able to do those very basic things.
And I can tell you that when we distribute these goods, and one of the things that ViStar does contribute is volunteers. It's a big job to actually man the distribution centers when we give out the clothing and other materials that are needed. You can see that there are all kinds of folks that are in need of this stuff. And you also, it's very humbling, because I think you can be on the other side of that table and realize that, you know, they're, It could be any of us. So it really is an opportunity to be generous, to be kind, as Mr. Rogers would remind us, and to help help those in our community who could use it.
Well, again, looking for gently used cold weather items, sweaters, jackets, blankets, new socks, new underwear. David McGowan, WJCT President and CEO, and Kamal Gasper, Vice President of Community Engagement at ViStar Credit Union. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program. Join us again tomorrow when we'll be talking about the biggest stories of the week on our First Coast Week in Review. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.